What is really going on, crypto savages? You are listening to the Coin Spice podcast with host C. Edward Kelso, editor-in-chief at coinspice.io, your home for spicy crypto things on the net.
Well, this has been a long time coming. I actually know you from afar, only digitally, and I've really admired Xthinner to the extent that I can understand it. I'm not the sharpest tool in the shed. I love your tone on whether it's Reddit or Twitter, the way that you approach explaining topics to people, and no matter how kind of, you know, dickish they get, you tend to kind of keep things cool, calm, and collect. So anyway, that was a long way to go to say thank you very much for coming on the show, man. I really appreciate it.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
So let's get into it a little bit. Just about your background. From what I've read, you've actually been in the space for a long time, right? How did you actually find cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, and all that good stuff?
Yeah, so I first heard about Bitcoin during the great Slashdotting. I think that was in like 2012. At the time, I was poor and involved in a neuroscience startup, or I was a neuroscience startup, one-man startup. So I didn't actually like get invested or involved in Bitcoin at the time. But my brother and my mom did. So I guess you could say that cryptocurrency has been a family business for me for a while.
Your mom?
My mom's right there.
How did mom get involved in Bitcoin?
I think at one point she went by the Reddit handle Crypto Mom or something like that. But yeah, my brother got into it before she did, and then he and I kind of convinced her that it would be a good idea for her to become involved and to become invested.
Wow. Wow. This is back in 2012-ish?
Yeah. 2012, 2013. I started accepting donations for a open source brain training program that I was developing called Brain Workshop using both PayPal and Bitcoin. So I think we got like 3.5 Bitcoins of donations, which at the time seemed sort of nice because it was like $100 or a few $100, but sure. Now that would be about $15,000. But yeah, so that's where we started getting involved in it. I got involved in it as a payment method for donations. I also really liked the idea of using Bitcoin instead of credit cards because in 2013, 2014, I was making a fair number of sales for that startup that I mentioned, the neuroscience startup. And I got really annoyed that 2 to 3% out of every transaction that I made ended up going to the banks to pay for the credit card fees.
Right.
If that's the way that our economy is working, that banks are sucking 2 to 3% out of our economy, we should do something about that. We should fix that. And I thought that crypto could be a way to fix that.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people miss it, especially if they're on the backside of the economy, in the sense that they only, you know, are consumers, that once you hang out your own shingle or try to do your own business, it sort of opens your eyes to how much, you know, as you say, this kind of giant sucking sound of the banking system just kind of eats at everything you're doing. That's really interesting. So there's not necessarily a connection between your neuroscience work and Bitcoin or crypto. It just happened that you were, I guess, an entrepreneur, right?
Yeah, I'm an entrepreneur. I've also always been a techie. Even when I was in high school, I was learning how to program and playing around with hardware. My brother was usually more software-based, and I was usually more hardware-based. So around in 2012, when I was choosing between cryptocurrency and my neuroscience startup, I thought that it might be fun to try to do Bitcoin mining as a hobby, but I ended up not doing that because I didn't have enough money to do both that and the neuroscience startup. So I chose neuroscience for a year and a half. Then I chose Bitcoin mining afterwards.
Interesting. Really, really interesting. So my assumption then is that you come over to the Bitcoin cash side of things years later, and I'm jumping over, you know, probably some, I know I am, some major events that kind of pushed you along the way. But it was the payment side of things, the Bitcoin that I remember hearing about, that was hardly ever talked. I mean, it was always called digital gold in some circles, but really what people were excited about was the peer-to-peer cash element of it. you were around to kind of see that narrative change, right?
Yeah. There's actually a really interesting chart or graph that somebody pulled together using, I think, Google Trends, showing the differences in frequency of use of different phrases like peer-to-peer cash versus digital gold versus censorship-resistant money and all those different aspects that Bitcoin could have been or is. And yeah, there was a big narrative shift that started around 2015, 2016, away from the peer-to-peer cash and payment network system use cases and toward the digital gold store of value kind of use cases. And I was always more interested in the censorship resistant aspect is interesting to me. I think that there is definitely use for a payment system that is not beholden to central bank mistakes, like Venezuela's mistakes. I also think that there's a lot of use for a native currency of the internet that is math-based, because that just makes it a lot easier to program things, to program your own web store or to program your own microservices application. So I really like that, those aspects. The store of value, like, that doesn't seem that exciting to me. I don't think that having a system in which early adopters can speculate and invest a lot of money and then get rich as later adopters pile on is really that beneficial of a system for humanity. And I can see how it can be beneficial for certain individuals, and I can see how those individuals might want to advocate its use that way, but it seems just so petty and zero-sum gamey. So I much prefer the things that give Bitcoin its value independent of giving individuals wealth. And I think that those are the systems or the aspects of Bitcoin that are seeing a lot less usability nowadays with full blocks. Even like the censorship resistance thing, people are saying that in order to maximize censorship resistance, you have to keep blocks small so that everybody can run a full node in their garage or whatever. And I think that that's missing half of the equation. Full node costs are one side of the, or one column in your accounting system for how much it costs to run a business, less so for a user, but that's a side point. The main thing is that if the transaction fees themselves are too high, that's going to be the dominant driver of how much it costs to use Bitcoin. And if, for example, transaction fees are $1, that means that in a country like Venezuela, where a monthly salary is $7 per month, you can't use Bitcoin effectively. You can't even set up a channel to use Lightning Network when it takes two to three days worth of salary just to set up one channel, plus another 2 to 3 days that you have to keep in reserve to close it. It's like a week's worth of salary. And that's, you know, who's going to not eat for a week or 2 weeks just so they can set up a Lightning Network channel? Not very many people.
Right. So, and you're speaking of kind of the current narrative anyway, for the last few years has been for the Bitcoin Core camp, some of the developers there, sort of the dominant cadre there, to offer what is known as a second layer solution to, lack of it, like, let them eat cake. So keep the chain, you know, pure. And for the store of value kind of gold bug aspects and the HODL crew and the Lambo guys, and then they can have this over-engineered, although it seems very cool in some aspects, Lightning Network that involves setting up channels, like you say, and nodes. And it just seems to really, when they're, at least Bitcoin Cash exists as kind of like, hello, I see this all the time on Twitter. Some enterprising journalist for a major crypto outlet will be like, hey, I just set up, you know, my life. It took me, you know, 17 independent conversations with people with PhDs to do it, but I finally did it. And then they're inevitably disappointed. But yeah. Also, it's like Bitcoin Cash exists. Right? So if you wanted micropayments, you can do that right now without all the fuss and the muss. But in any event, we kind of skipped over. So you were always in the Bitcoin payment camp, or I should say the medium of exchange camp without kind of having knowing that that was, you know, a side necessarily. It just sort of seemed to kind of go with what Bitcoin seemed to be for. And then that narrative changed. Was it ever, did you ever think to yourself like, gee whiz, you know, maybe it's just safer to stay with the ticker and the crowd that's BTC? Like what eventually brought you over to BCH? Like, why didn't you go to Litecoin or something else like that?
So, it sounds like you might not know a lot of my history of involvement in this space. Did you ever hear about Bitcoin XT?
A little bit.
So I was one of the developers, junior developers for Bitcoin XT. Did you hear about Bitcoin Classic?
Yes.
I was one of the co-founders of Bitcoin Classic.
Oh, wow.
Fairly early on, I got involved in the big block camp. I thought that Bitcoin couldn't grow, couldn't become what it had the potential to be unless the block size limit was increased. And I was quite active in several of the early efforts to try to do that in a consensus-based mechanism with, you know, a 3/4 majority of the miners in support of a hard fork, for example, for Bitcoin Classic. So, I didn't want to split the currency into two. I didn't want to have a fracture where we would have maybe, say, 90% of the value on a small blockchain and the remaining 10% on a big blockchain and have the ability to send payments between parties on those two blockchains to be compromised by an inability to agree. I really wanted to see everybody get together and say, yes, this is what we as a community are going to do, and this is how we're going to do it, and this is how we're going to stick to a coherent vision that enables both massive global adoption as well as keeping centralization from rearing its ugly head. And that didn't happen. And I think that the main reason why that didn't happen is because Famos decided to censor the Reddit r Bitcoin and Bitcoin Talk and the Bitcoin Wiki and started banning users who expressed pro-fork opinions and kicked us off into a separate community. And I think that right there, that decision to censor one side of the debate and to ostracize anybody who decided to express opinions in favor of that side of the debate, despite the censorship, I think that ruined it, and that caused the hard fork, the controversial non-consensus hard fork that we have with Bitcoin Cash. So, yeah, and I think that we're still suffering from the effects of that decision of Famos today. I think that one of the reasons why we have so many difficulties with communication between camps is because instead of trying to sit down together as a community, as a bunch of people, and to hash out our differences and our arguments and come to a resolution, what we did was we just had a moderator team exclude one side of the debate and push them off, and that left that rift unsolved. And since then, we've just had two echo chambers, and people have mostly only been talking to people within their camp and reinforcing their existing preconceptions or ideas or ideals about how Bitcoin should be, and not actually engaging in dialogue. And so our Bitcoin and our BTC have just been growing even more different in their opinions since then.
Yeah, and the the fallout from that seems to be even beyond just, you know, Bitcoin and eventually in August of 2017, Bitcoin Cash. It seems to be that a lot of people just got fed up with it completely and just went on and created. I mean, there's probably inevitable that there would be altcoins and, you know, just the nature of open source. But I think the market and its robustness, relatively speaking, is probably due a lot to that censorship, right?
So I don't know about the market dynamics being caused by censorship. I do think that so my opinion is that the reason that Bitcoin, BTC, dropped in its market dominance in 2016 and 2017 is that people predicted that once the blocks would get full, fees would go up, and once fees went up beyond right. some certain threshold, it would discourage recent users, new users, old users, and cause them to become disillusioned in Bitcoin and leave the project. So, yeah, if you look at the market dominance charts, they were at like 90%, 95% pretty consistently for the first 6 years of Bitcoin's existence. Litecoin by itself didn't get very much adoption. And it was only when the block size started getting to around 900 kilobytes that that started to change. And then as fees went up, when fees spiked, the market dominance index spiked negatively. And the lowest market dominance index that we ever saw was at the time when Bitcoin's fees were at its peak in December, January of 2017, 2018. So I think that, the market was partially predicting the loss of usability and partially reacting to the loss of usability. So I don't think that that was actually because of censorship directly. It was more that censorship caused the loss of communication and the loss of intelligent decision-making ability that resulted in Bitcoin not fixing this very basic, straightforward, obvious problem of the 1 megabyte block size limit.
Right. And so you eventually, that's a much better way to put it, way more nuanced, certainly more accurate. But so you eventually then kind of move over, if you have a camp, to your, at least some of the development I've seen online in some of the subreddits, you move over to working on Bitcoin Cash. Is that, in terms of crypto, your exclusive focus, or do you still maintain some work on the BTC side?
My loyalty is to big blocks, not to Bitcoin Cash. If BTC were to increase its block size limit and commit to a strategy of keeping the block size as high as is safe given current technology and block propagation methods, hardware capability, etc., then my loyalty would shift towards BTC. I think that the fact that BTC has so much history and so much network effect and so much name recognition is worth a lot. And I'm not interested in trying to have Bitcoin Cash overcome that name recognition if we don't have to.
Right.
So, yeah, I would gladly switch over to BTC if they increase the block size limit, but they're not going to.
Right. I think they made that clear.
Yeah, given that, my interests lie with, I mean, I also like Ethereum a lot. I've considered getting into Ethereum development, but there were some decisions made fairly early on in the design of Ethereum that makes it a lot harder to scale Ethereum. It's basically the way they do state root tree commitments after every transaction. So just to give you like a quick primer, a commitment is where you write a hash of something into the blockchain, and that commitment summarizes the state of something in the blockchain at that time. With Ethereum, the state that's being committed is the entire blockchain's state, all the account balances and all the arbitrary data that's in each account gets committed to the blockchain, and it happens after every transaction. And that provides a very high level of assurance for verifying transactions. You can verify each transaction independently pretty much, but it also means that a lot of computation has to be done by full nodes when they're verifying each transaction, and that computation ends up slowing down the maximum transaction throughput of Ethereum to about 20 transactions per second. So,
it almost dooms it, right?
Yeah, I mean, there are ways of getting around it, but it's a steep uphill battle to do that. Basically, the sharding idea is pretty much the only or one of the few ways of solving that problem. Either you can shard the blockchain into a bunch of pieces so that each full node is fully verifying a different part of the blockchain, or you can try to move as many transactions as possible off the blockchain into second layer networks like Raiden. which is basically Ethereum's equivalent of Lightning. So those are kind of the two ideas, or Plasma, also very similar to Raiden. Those are the two ideas for how you scale a blockchain that has that kind of fine-grained state commitment overhead. And Bitcoin Cash does not have that overhead. It does not have the Bitcoin equivalent of these state tree commitments would be UTXO commitments. So Bitcoin Cash does not currently have UTXO commitments. We're planning on adding them, but when we add them, we're going to do them in a more lightweight fashion, and not after every transaction, but at most after every block, and probably after every like 10 or 100 blocks. So that overhead is amortized over a much longer period of time and doesn't impact the total transaction throughput of the system.
So this kind of, I think, naturally leads into, because you were talking about being a big blocker, or, you know, that is your goal in terms of making payments, you know, essentially faster, cheaper, more reliable. Is that what leads us then into your work with Xthinner and block propagation?
So my interest in Xthinner, it really actually, so Xthinner was born during the hard fork debate of 2018, where people were debating about what to do with CTOR, whether it was a good idea or not. And it seemed, well, so CTOR was designed for two reasons. One reason was to improve block validation by enabling a parallel block validation algorithm. And the other reason was to improve block propagation performance by reducing the entropy in blocks by choosing one predetermined or deterministic ordering for transactions in a block. You could get rid of any information that you would need to encode that ordering, because the recipient would be able to reconstruct that order no matter what. So that was an information theoretic argument. It was a practical argument for a protocol known as Graphene, which didn't inherently transmit any order information. The order information had to be transmitted separately. So it was obvious to see where that information, where that efficiency would show up with Graphene with CTOR. But it wasn't obvious where it would show up with a system more like compact blocks. Xthinner was born when I was thinking about the compact blocks encoding scheme and thinking about CTOR and thinking, where is that redundant information? If I was going to remove the information that CTOR makes redundant out of compact blocks, where would it be? Where would it show up? How would I get rid of it? And I realized that the first few bytes of every transaction ID would be the same with CTOR. And so Xthinner was designed in order to get rid of those first few bytes, and also to get rid of any trailing bytes that were unnecessary for disambiguating between the transaction that was in the block and the transactions that are in mempool. And that's basically all that Xthinner is. It says, okay, here's transaction one. Here's the first few bytes for transaction one. These bytes are shared with the next, you know, 10 transactions. Here's the unique byte that identifies transaction one from transaction A and transaction B in mempool. And then here's transaction two. It uses these unique bytes. Here's transaction three. It uses these unique bytes, etc. The reason that I did Xthinner was because block propagation has always been a sore spot for scaling for blockchains. It's one of the big arguments that the Bitcoin Core small block crowd used against scaling, and it's one that does have some truth to it. And if you allow block propagation to get too long, it rewards pools for being large. When block propagation takes a long time, the chance of an orphan race of two competing blocks being published at about the same time and competing with each other for dominance increases. And whenever you have these orphan races, pools with larger hash rate proportions tend to win. If a pool has 30% of the network hash rate, they are going to mine the second block that, you know, solves the orphan race problem 30% of the time. That means that a pool with 30% of the hash rate is going to win 65% of all of their orphan races, when that happens, these large pools get a disproportionate amount of revenue, and that encourages miners to join the big pools and makes them get even bigger, thereby exacerbating the problem and potentially running into a runaway centralization scenario. So we don't want that to happen, and we can avoid having that happen by making sure that blocks propagate very quickly and that these orphan races are rare. My opinion is that around 20 seconds is the amount of delay at which these orphan races start to become a significant problem, and we shouldn't let block propagation get longer than 20 seconds on a regular basis. Ideally, we'd have it be around 2 to 5 seconds. That's roughly my target. The Bitcoin Core camp believes that we should have it around 150 milliseconds, which I think is excessive. At 150 milliseconds, orphan races happen about 0.02% of the time, which is, 0.02% is better than, 1%, but I think it's an excessively high safety standard and results in compromises elsewhere. It results in compromises in block size and in block throughput and in fees, and it makes a bad trade-off. So that's basically the issue that we have going on. We want block propagation to be as fast as possible so we can get a good scale / centralization security balance. And if we improve block propagation, then either we get more scale or we get more anti-centralization security or both. It just improves the trade-off or improves the basic resource that we're trying to deal with. So I was interested in block propagation in 2015. One of the first talk that I gave on Bitcoin was actually about the block propagation performance that we had with Bitcoin XT, with mostly with the 9.1 megabyte block size limit that we would have on testnet at the time, and also to some extent with the thin blocks system that Mike Hearn had just coded. And so we did a bunch of tests with that. We made a few thousand blocks using a testnet network of around 20 nodes scattered all around the globe. It was actually a real Bitcoin network, not a main network, because it was using fake money, but it was using real servers. And we got some block propagation data from that. And we saw that, block propagation across the Chinese border really, really sucks. We saw that for most of the world, we were able to propagate 9 megabyte blocks in around 10 or 20 seconds. But when they were crossing the Chinese border, it would take about 4 times as long as anywhere else.
Wow. And why is that?
Packet loss.
And that is that due to the government censorship there, or just the lack of...
At the time, I thought that this was caused by the Great Firewall itself, by the Golden Shield Project, as they call it. Uh-huh. My understanding has evolved since then. So the idea was that the government was intentionally dropping packets, not affecting latency or throughput, just dropping random packets, and doing this in order to give a bias or a usability bias in favor of domestic services in China. So this would be a way of handicapping companies like Google or Bing, and
I remember this.
Because who really wants? You can use Bing in China. It's just a little bit slower, unless Bing puts its servers directly in China, it's a lot slower. So that was what I thought was going on. But I have done more research since then, and it seems that what's actually going on is just corruption. It's government corruption, basically. There are three major Chinese ISPs or telecoms. There's China Mobile, there's China Unicom, and China Telecom. And two out of those three, China Unicom and China Telecom, have a policy of intentionally under-provisioning bandwidth at exchange locations, especially international exchanges, and charging a premium for access to uncongested ports. And the premium that they charge is not based on the cost that is incurred by them in providing those ports, but solely based on demand. So you see a very strange pattern with China Unicom or China Telecom connections, in that the closer you are to China, the more expensive it is. It can cost around $50 to $100 per megabit per second to get a connection from Hong Kong to Shenzhen, whereas it costs about $5 per megabit per second to get a connection from Los Angeles to Shenzhen. So they're charging more based on demand, and they're intentionally crippling their service in order to artificially stimulate demand. And there are ways of getting around these things, but because, so most of the routing tables, most of the BGP routing tables on the internet are designed to optimize for transit cost, not for optimizing for transit latency or throughput. And consequently, even if you're trying really hard to get these communication channels to go fast and are willing to spend money on it, your packets will sometimes just go through a slow, lossy route because it's cheaper, just because like there are so many different ways in which these BGP tables can go wrong and push you back towards a slower path. So something that I often saw when I was living in China and living in Hong Kong is that trying to send communication from Hong Kong to Shenzhen or vice versa would often result in a 200 or 250 millisecond round trip latency, when it should be about 10 milliseconds. And the reason for that is because of something we call the Asia boomerang. Packets would often go from Hong Kong to Los Angeles to Shenzhen.
Because it was so much cheaper to go.
Because that's the cheapest route, yeah.
Yeah.
Hong Kong to Los Angeles is cheap. Los Angeles to China is cheap. Hong Kong straight to China is not. So, yeah. So I think that that's what was going on with our tests on Bitcoin XT. The issue is much smaller if you can condense your blocks down to 1/25th of the normal size. That's what Xthin did. So when Xthin was released in 2015/2016, it dramatically reduced that Great Firewall problem. And it reduced the, so in like 2015, 2014, we were seeing block propagation times on the order of 50 seconds for things that crossed the Great Firewall, at least to some of the pools like Ant Pool and BTC China. F2 Pool was doing a bit better. I think they had a relay network of their own, or they were connected to Matt Corral's relay network in a better fashion. So F2 Pool was usually doing more like 10, 15 seconds, and then down later on down to 2 to 5 seconds. But I think the reason that we were seeing those 50-second block propagation times for some of the pools was because of that Great Firewall issue combined with uncompressed blocks. And then once we got Xthin and compact blocks, we got that down to around 5 seconds, 2 to 5 seconds. And then once Fiber was released by Matt Carlo and Greg Maxwell, that brought things down to about 0.15 seconds. So, yeah, anyway.
That's fascinating. So you have been involved in one form or another on these issues, and we kind of, I took you on a jag here into China, but it was fascinating. So you've actually been working on the block issue since, well, just about 4 years, right? So
Since 4 years, but I started working on it in 2015, 2016. I started working on a protocol called BlockTorrent around that time. Then when Bitcoin Fiber was released in mid-2016, I said, okay, this is good enough for the near future. Until we actually have big blocks, there's no need to go make anything other than Fiber. So I took a break at that point and didn't really start doing block propagation stuff again until 2018.
Okay, and so with Xthinner, I've seen various updates. Is it safe to say that it's still kind of in its really early phases?
I would say it's adolescent. Like it got its first job a while ago, and you know it's starting to make a little bit of spending cash. It's mostly just mowing lawns at this point, but you know it's growing up. It's not quite ready for prime time. It's not ready to start its full-time career. and it still needs a little bit of support and love and care from its parents, but it's getting there. It's starting to do something useful. So yeah, it's currently active and running on two of my servers on mainnet. It's propagating blocks. People can use it right now on mainnet if they want to. I don't recommend doing that with any...
So we've got cut off there. So going back, Extinner and your work there, you said it is kind of in its adolescent phase, that it's on two of your servers, and then I kind of lost you. So you know, kind of pick up from there, I guess.
Sure. Yeah. So Extinner is coming along. It's it still has some work to be done on review, on code review, on making sure that it's not buggy and dangerous to run. It may have some buffer overflow bugs in it. It may have some segfault bugs in it. It's possible that there's an issue still by which a remote attacker could cause your nodes to crash or cause your nodes to run any code that the attacker wants. I can't rule that out just because we haven't done security review yet. But it is functional, and the core functionality appears to be working reliably bug-free. It's been running between my nodes for about 1 week so far, and over the last 1,000-ish blocks, it has failed zero times. So,
wow.
Yeah. I mean, it was always designed... Actually, I did find a serious encoding bug around 2 weeks ago, I think. And that encoding bug was causing Extinner to not encode enough information in order to disambiguate transactions from mempool transactions. So it was running into these ambiguity errors about 75% of the time. And even with those ambiguity errors, it was still not failing, which is kind of interesting and kind of encouraging. When it was running into those ambiguity errors 75% of the time, it would just identify the ambiguity as being ambiguous and fall back and request that transaction, that ambiguous transaction. So
does that go to the kind of the robustness of the code?
Right, exactly. Like the design of Extinner was intended to make sure that all errors and all ambiguities, all decoding problems could be isolated to one part of the block, to one specific transaction index. And that allows for that specific transaction index to be requested in a fallback method. That's kind of something like that is necessary in order to handle situations in which the recipient and the sender have asynchronous or desynchronous mempools. When some transactions are in the recipient's mempool but not in the sender's, or vice versa. That's just a natural problem with all these block propagation techniques. And having a way to resolve that situation in a fashion that works for any amount of desynchrony, I think, is important for block propagation protocols. And that was specifically the attribute that Graphene lacks. If desynchrony exceeds some threshold with Graphene, then the decoding of the IBLTs, the decoding of the Graphene messages, simply fails. And you have to fall back to a completely different protocol. But with Extinner, it doesn't completely fail. It only fails for those specific indices, and then you can just request those indices. So yeah. So that bug was, I guess, proof that the core idea behind having indexable resolution was beneficial for robustness.
And that's really encouraging to hear. Now, to ask for less technical people, who I can only assume if they stayed with us this far, their heads are exploding. Yeah, for less technical folks out there, I'm pretending I'm not one. So how does Extinner impact their lives if they're a cat? In other words, they want to use this for Amazon. They want to use this in Venezuela to pay, you know, a fruit cart pilot. And then, so let me ask first before you go to that one. Would you sell this? Would this be incorporated into a node? implementation. Would something like ABC or potentially or BU or something like that pick it up and incorporate it into the code in a later hard fork? Do you see the two questions I'm asking there?
Yeah. So I'll answer the last part of the last question first and just go in reverse order. It's not a hard fork. It's not a soft fork. It's not a fork. Xthinner does not require any forks to the protocol, at least for BCH. It did require CTOR to be forked in. It is does have CTOR as a dependency, but that was already added in November. So any client can add Xthinner support whenever they want to. And doing so is both backwards and forwards compatible with all other clients. So it can be done today. It could be done 3 weeks ago. I did it 3 weeks ago. I didn't ask for anybody's permission. It's active on mainnet. The code that I wrote is based on Bitcoin ABC. So I have my own branch of Bitcoin ABC with Xthinner support. Once it's gone through security review and hopefully passed, I expect it will be merged into Bitcoin ABC. I expect it will also get ported over to Bitcoin Unlimited. I've also got a guy who is interested in porting it into Bitprim. It should be supported pretty much everywhere. What does this mean for the average Joe in Venezuela? Well, that's harder to say something about. So Venezuelans are going to be using SPV clients. They're not going to be downloading the full blocks. So they won't be using Xthinner directly. People who use full nodes as just a economic full node, not a mining full node, but a regular full node because they want to validate all the blocks, can use Xthinner, and it will reduce their block transmission bandwidth by a factor of 3, but the block transmission bandwidth is going to be a very small portion of their total bandwidth. Most of the bandwidth is used by transmitting transactions and announcing which transactions you have. So it's not going to reduce bandwidth for full nodes. Mostly all it's going to do is it's going to improve block propagation latency on the P2P network without any relay network overlays or any permissioned systems in which, like Bloxroot Labs or Fiber in its trusted node. So it allows for a higher guarantee of block transmission throughput, and that in turn enables larger block sizes while still being safe and performant and having low orphan rates and low centralization. So if that happens, then Xthinner can enable higher transaction throughput, higher system-wide capacity, larger numbers of users, lower fees, and wider reach. So that's really what Xthinner is aiming for. It's aiming for the systemic level improvements, not for the end user improvements.
And it is those systemic improvements that ultimately the end user becomes the beneficiary over time, right?
Right. So there is, I guess, one potential direct benefit. Xthinner may cause miners to accept transactions that have lower fees. So fees might go from 0.3 cents down to 0.1 cents with Xthinner. That might be exciting to some people, it might not.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Fascinating stuff. And so let's end it here with your general take, and I appreciated your candor when speaking about your lack of interest in a ticker so much as just, you know, the actual nuts and bolts of software and the actual code. Focusing on Bitcoin Cash for just a second, where are you now with it? Like, are you hopeful for it going forward? We've got a software upgrade, depending on how you look at it, or fork coming up. What are your thoughts coming up on the 15th here and maybe in the more immediate future on BCH?
I think that currently, Bitcoin Cash has the best user experience of any of the blockchain-based money systems out there. I think that it has more capacity than Litecoin does. It has lower fees and more capacity and greater ease of use than BTC does. So I think that from a technical slash UX perspective, Bitcoin Cash should win. But I do see that the network advantage that BTC has and that also Ethereum has is very large, and overcoming that is going to be very hard. And not convinced that BCH is going to be able to do that, especially with the narrative that Bitcoin BTC is using, that Bitcoin Cash is a scam, that it is trying to steal the Bitcoin name, etc. I think that that narrative seems to be having a lot of weight and having a lot of influence on newbies and scaring them away from what I perceive as the superior technology. So given that, I'm not completely sure that Bitcoin Cash is going to win. I would actually give it about a 25% chance that it is going to overtake BTC. However, it's currently 5% of the price. So I think that it is a, from the speculator's perspective, I think it's a bargain. I think that expected value is roughly quintupling your current investment on it. And if Bitcoin Cash gets closer to BTC in terms of price and in terms of volume, user volume, transaction volume, et cetera, then I think that the likelihood that BCH is going to win increases, and the likelihood or the expected value of investments in it also increases. So yeah, I personally have been trying to accumulate more BCH, mostly through mining, and trying to reduce my holdings in other currencies.
Even though the network effect itself may seem daunting, you still hold out a lot of hope for it, and it could be that BTC just continues on, Ethereum becomes world computer or whatever it is that they're looking for, and Bitcoin Cash could theoretically become peer-to-peer cash for the world, and that's maybe not a bad deal.
Yeah, well, I think that BTC doesn't have that much growth potential anymore. I think that it's got a few million users. If it gets 25% more users or 25% more use, then it runs into that fee ceiling, and users get scared away until it has less than its threshold or less than its limit in users. And I don't think that it's going to grow more in terms of value per transaction, or at least not much more. So my scenarios are either BTC stagnates or BTC is replaced by BCH. Or they both fail. I guess that's also a possibility.
Sure. Well, of course I like the BCH taking over. So I'm gonna hold on to that. I can't thank you enough for coming on the show, for explaining all this to us. And it was nice to get a history lesson too. And with your involvement, I really, really, really do appreciate that. Xthinner is an awesome project, and everybody I talk to is just super impressed by it. So best of luck with that. Where can people find your work? Where can they follow you?
GitHub. I'm mostly on Twitter. Mostly not on Twitter. I hate Twitter. I'm mostly on Reddit. But people can also, find me on Telegram if you want a personal conversation, at J2MIM. I'm J2MIM on most places, as long as you spell it right with an M at the end.
Cool. And we'll link to all that in the show notes. You've been exceedingly generous with your time and with all my technical screw-ups here. So thank you so much for doing this, and best of luck, man.
Thanks.